This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Daisy Turner grew up in Grafton, in a home her father built that was known as Journey's End. Daisy was one of 13 children of freed slaves, born in 1883. She lived 104 years, and her story still lives on today. Today on the program, we're going to explore the life and legacy of Daisy Turner. Her family saga is captured in a new book by folklorist and historian Jane Beck. And Jane will help us understand why she thinks Daisy's story is vitally important. Daisy died in 1988, but we are going to hear her voice today. This clip is excerpted from the Vermont Folklife Center archive, which has preserved some of Daisy's stories. And let me just set this up for you. In 1891, when Daisy was eight, her elementary school held a pageant. All the young girls were assigned a doll and a piece of poetry by their teacher. Daisy's doll and poem were different from the other girls, and both were focused on the fact that she was the only African-American student in the class. But as each girl stood and read, Daisy got more and more determined.
And finally, it got down to me with this black doll. So I said, I'm not going to do it. And of course, the teacher and I were back behind. And she was saying, oh, and I was pulling, no, I wouldn't go. And she kept urging me. She said she'd let me wear her watch and that she'd give me paper money and all. So I finally consented. But I was so angry, my voice was high. And I said, you needn't crowd my dolly out, although she's black as night. And if she is at the foot of this show, I think she'll stand as good a chance as the dollies that are white. My daddy says that half the world was nearly dark as night, and it does no harm to take a chance and to stay right in the fight. So stand up, Dolly. So sit up, Dolly, and look straight to the judges at the right. I'll stand right by your side if I do look afraid. And so I went on saying my piece. Through. But instead of saying the piece that the teacher had taught me to say, I was saying what I wanted to say on my own. And so I said, the teacher's face is all can see, is redder than a beet. And Dad had come down from the back and had led her to a seat and gave to me that famous Turner look. So I sat down and shut my mouth up tight, just like a book. Well, nobody said a word to me. They didn't know what to make of it. They were all amazed. They didn't know whether they ought to applaud or whether it was good or bad. But it kind of broke up the thing. But when they got through with it in the end, they gave me the first prize. It was the $10 gold piece.
You can picture Daisy Turner just telling that story in her own words. And for Jane Beck, our guest today, it is important to hear these kinds of personal stories, even with embellishments and with the inevitable unreliability of memory. Jane Beck's new book is called Daisy Turner's Kin, an African-American Family Saga. Jane, it's a pleasure to have you with us today.
Well, thank you so much.
What does that story tell us about Daisy Turner? It's one of the stories that is something that she told often, and it's something that you hold up as one of her touchstone stories. Why? What's important about that story?
The important thing is at the age of eight, she suddenly found her voice and could stand up and say, hey, wait a minute. You're not getting the whole story.
So when she was just 8 years old, though, she was able to do that? I mean, any eight-year-old standing up in front of all of these adults and in front of a teacher who's telling you what to do, this voice of authority, and then to feel like you're somehow different from the rest of the class as the only black student in this small school in Vermont, she must have had a lot of self-confidence even at that early age to be able to do that.
I think that is certainly true, but also her background. Every night after dinner, the family would tell stories, recite poetry. And I asked her if she could remember, you know, what the teacher gave her to say. And the teacher said, and Daisy said, no, I was just angry. And I said, did you know you were talking in rhyme? No, I was angry.
So she told you that story. And then in that recording that we heard, were you doing the recording of that as well?
Yes.
So where was she when she did that? What was the scene like?
She lived in a house in the village by this time, the house on the hill Journey's End had burned. And so her brother-in-law had built this house, and she was living there.
And she was just hanging out? I mean, it sounds like she's giving a performance almost.
Well, she, you know, I had a lot of trouble. I would say after interviewing somebody for a while, you get a closer relationship. And I would say, Aunt Daisy, can I bring a videographer to record you? And she'd say, well, I have to ask my lawyers. I have to ask my nephews. And so this went on for quite a while. And then finally, I just said, Aunt Daisy, I'm bringing the videographer. And so when she finally came out, she was telling her story to the camera and to a new person, and she just really nailed it.
Did you say Aunt Daisy? Is that what she asked you to call her?
Yes, yes.
Tell us a little bit about who Daisy Turner was, what her story is.
Well, the reason I think she is so important is that she listened to her father tell his story, and he had grown up as a slave of John Golden. And she really listened to him carefully. And the interesting thing about Alec Turner was that once he was free, most people who had been enslaved did not look back. They only looked forward. But he wanted his family to know their history. And his father had been enslaved before him. And that, I think, is really unusual.
So Daisy grew up, the daughter, one of 13 children of Alec Turner, who was a freed slave, and of his wife. What was her childhood like in Vermont?
She lived just as any other hill farmer's daughter. And Alec, when he came to Vermont in 1873, and he totally cleared the land and built the buildings, and then bought the land and, you know, farmed a small hill farm. And he was really a dynamic person and very powerful and magnetic. And once people got to know him, he became part of the community. And I think that is important to realize.
And so his children were too, Daisy felt like part of the community growing up?
Very much so. They did not feel discriminated against until Daisy had this incident at school. And boy, she nipped it right in the bud.
Today, we're talking about Daisy Turner. You may have learned about her in school, if you went to school in Vermont, or through the Folklife Center. Today, though, we're getting a fuller story of this vibrant, sometimes provocative, and incredibly gifted storyteller. Jane Beck, who founded the Folklife Center in Middlebury, has come through on a promise she made to Daisy 30 years ago to put her story in a book. The book is called Daisy Turner's Kin, and it tells the story of the Turner family, starting with her great-grandparents' lives in West Africa, and really tracing the arc of African-American experience in the United States through slavery, independence, and life in Vermont in the 1900s. Listeners, if you have a question about Daisy Turner's life or a question for Jane Beck about how she went about doing this research and this book, how she verified some of Daisy's stories, you can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your comments on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Jane, when you first met Daisy in 1983, her reputation kind of preceded her, and it sounds like you were a little bit nervous to go up and introduce yourself. Can you tell us that story?
Well, usually in interviewing somebody, you can always get an introduction. And what I learned about Daisy was she had a shotgun and wasn't scared of using it. So I wrote her a letter, finally, when I couldn't find somebody to introduce us. And then, of course, I had to go through the agony of waiting. And the first time I called, there was no answer. The second time, next day, I called. And I knew Daisy was 100, and I get this ringing, hello? And I said, Miss Turner? Yes? and so then I sort of started in on why I wanted to meet her, and she got sick of that. And she said, well, she said, are you a prejudiced woman? And I said, I don't think so. Well, come anytime. So I said, okay, next Wednesday. And we were off and running.
Yeah, and that really started a very fruitful shared experience that the two of you had. I mean, you used to run errands for her and help her try to organize what appears to be a very, very messy collection of letters and documents and all kinds of things. How did you get Daisy Turner to trust you? Because often, as you write, she would let people into her life and then decide that they were untrustworthy later. But you held her trust.
Yeah, I was, you know, I knew that I might not. And there was one time where she had told me to go visit somebody. And I took down all the information. I made the appointment. It was down in New York. And then she decided she didn't like this person. So I didn't quite dare to tell her. And anyway, I went and saw the person. She was very helpful. I came back. I didn't tell Daisy. And then I walked in one day, and she started in on me. And I thought, oh, my gosh, here we go. And so she said, why didn't you tell me? And I said, well, and Daisy, I was scared to. At which point she cracked up, and I realized it was all right. But that was the closest I came. And
not everybody in Grafton felt the same way about Daisy as you came to feel. Why did people – I mean, not everybody, but some people disliked her. Some people thought she was untrustworthy. Some people told you, actually, specifically, why are you listening to this woman and writing down her stories?
She was cantankerous, and she wouldn't put up with anything. And, you know, she was always at the town because her road was bad or there was this or was that. And I think life changed in Grafton in her 100 years. I think the Wyndham Foundation came in and that changed things. And so the Wyndham Foundation, which she called the Windham Foundation, became her antagonist almost. And she would, you know, make up whoppers about the Wyndham Foundation. But it was more that life had changed.
So why did you think she was so worth forging a relationship with, really working hard to get her story not just down on paper, but to have those recorded interviews on video and that audio that we now get to hear that's so powerful?
She brought – well, I was amazed. Personally, she brought me into another time, a time I'd only read about. And her mastery of storytelling – brought the stories alive. She had a story about her father heard the hoofbeats of Lincoln as he rode away from shooting Booth. And I mean,
Booth shooting Lincoln.
But she just could bring you right there. And I thought, what an experience. And she went back to the early 1800s in Africa. And this fascinated me. And I began to realize as she was telling me this story, and her father was in the same tradition, and his father was, and it came straight from the African griot tradition where you have one person in the community that is the historian, the genealogist, the singer, the storyteller. And it's a different kind of tradition, and it is preserved in a very different way.
You write that Daisy's longevity also makes the story remarkable because it does span so much time and so much history that often – I think you said that people's stories and family stories last about 3 generations. But in Daisy's case, because she was 100 years old when you started talking to her, it was like 175 years back in time that she was telling these stories about.
Right.
So Daisy Turner had all of these stories. You call her a raconteur, you know, in the most classic sense. She was the storyteller. What's another one of the stories that she told you that was one of these what you call touchstone stories that she kept coming back to as this sort of key story or turning point in her life?
Well, let me use one of her father's stories.
Sure.
Because I think, again, it's a touchstone story. It's a story where he first realized what it meant to be a slave. And he noticed when Children were young on the plantation. They played with both white children and black children. And he noticed that he was dressed differently. And he went to his mother and he said, I don't have any shoes and I'm only got this smock. And she didn't really say anything, but she made him a pair of red moccasins, which he noticed he was very proud of. But he noticed that she always took them off when a white person appeared. And one day, his mother was the seamstress, and the lady of the house came down. And she finds him in his moccasins, and she throws them in the fire. And he goes berserk. He's five. He kicks her. He bites her. He punches her, and she falls into a swoon, and they come and they carry him off. And all he remembers seeing was this awful look in his mother's eye. And she was afraid that he was going to be sold off the plantation as a punishment. And this is the moment that he realizes what it means to be enslaved.
And he told Daisy, and Daisy then could tell you and tell the world what this was like.
Yeah.
And she also tells a story from her father, Alec Turner, about learning to read. And he was actually taught by the granddaughter of the slave owner, right? And how powerful that was for him in furthering the rest of his life. What's that story?
Well, that story is there was a little girl on the plantation. It was 3 years older than he was. And she brought a little primer and was teaching him behind the milk house. And her grandmother catches them, sends the granddaughter to the house, lashes Alec, and he holds on to that primer, and his blood falls on the primer. And this primer means so much to him that once he runs away, he carries it throughout the Civil War. And that was at Journey's End when the house burned.
Oh, so you didn't get to see it.
So I didn't get to see it, but I heard about it.
We're learning about the life of Daisy Turner, who grew up in Grafton and lived to be 104 years old. Her longevity helped preserve a family story that traces back three or four generations, and her role as a storyteller has brought her family saga to life, from West Africa through the slave plantations of the South, and finally to a home her family called Journey's End in Grafton. Coming up, we're going to dive into why our guest today, Jane Beck, thinks Daisy's story was so important to preserve, and about what the role of memory and storytelling and oral history plays in our cultural understanding. And listeners, if you have a question about Daisy Turner, she's a person and a name known through Vermont, but perhaps sort of vaguely known, like you've heard the story of Daisy Turner, but you can't quite remember all the details. Well, if you have a question for Jane, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Jane Beck is my guest today. She's a historian and the founder of the Vermont Folklife Center in Middlebury. And she's just written a book about a woman who's occupied her mind for more than three decades. She tells the story in Daisy Turner's Kin, an African-American family saga. We're learning more about Daisy Turner today. And listeners, if you have a question for Jane Beck, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page or at vpr.net. We've been learning a little bit about Daisy Turner herself and how she preserved these stories that her father had told her. And Jane, you mentioned that they were stories going back into his early life as a slave, a thing that actually was not very common, that a lot of former slaves did not want to talk about that life when they were freed or when they escaped. And Daisy's story helps illuminate some of these stories of slaves that we often don't get to hear in this sort of personal sense. As we continue talking about this, let's go to the calls. We've got Reginald, who's on the line with us from Saxton's River. Hi, Reginald. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. I'm calling to find out if there is any way that Daisy or her father was able to document where in South Africa they originated.
They were Yoruba. And Daisy told me that they were Yoruba, and I was able to do a genome test on a son of a son of a son, and that came out Yoruba as well. So probably it was somewhere in the Bight of Benin and between somewhere near Badagary, somewhere in that area. I can't totally pinpoint it, but I know they went to Cape Coast Castle and went down the coast from there.
So, Jane, as long as we're already now in the Bight of Benin and in West Africa, can you tell us the story, as Daisy told you, about her family history? It's fascinating stuff. And then we're going to talk a little bit about this idea of embellishment and memory and how it can be unreliable but very important. But I'd love you to tell us the story of her great-grandparents.
Well, her great-grandmother was the daughter of an English trader, and she went out on her honeymoon in one of her father's trading vessels, and her husband was the trader.
And she was from London?
She was from London. And I never could track down. I had hoped I could. There was a terrible storm, which was probably a local tornado, which comes before the rainy season. And the ship foundered and was wrecked and went down. And her husband was drowned, and she was saved by an African chief's son who was a very powerful swimmer. Now, you don't swim in the Bight of Benin. The sea pours in. There are sharks. There are currents. And so that was very notable. She never is able to return to England. Maybe her – who knows why. But she has a child with her savior. And they name him Alexander after Alexander the Great. And he grows up in full Yoruba tradition, becomes involved in the slave trade, as Daisy said, got too smart for his own good, and was captured as a slave himself and brought to this country, probably in a ship called a schooner called the Phoenix, and was brought to New Orleans. This would have been about 1830.
And so this Alex Turner, Alexander Turner, became a Turner, I imagine, because he was
this Alexander, his name was Alessi, and he was given the name Robert when he was first bought. And the story is he was bought cheap, which he did not like. And it was because he was arrogant and a troublemaker.
He himself said it was because
yes.
He was arrogant?
I mean, this was the stuff carried down in the family. But probably he was sold illegally, and that was why he was sold cheap.
And so that Alex was Daisy's grandfather.
Yes.
And that Alex had Alec Turner, who was Daisy's
yes.
father.
Yes.
And Alex Turner, the one who came from Africa.
The African.
And, yes. And he married a Native American woman.
Right.
So
Cherokee
there's a lot of heritage
woman.
In
yes.
Daisy's family
yes.
as well. Let's go to Stephen, who's calling in from Huntington. Hi, Stephen. Go ahead.
Hi. I live in Huntington, and I've noticed a sign in Hinesburg about early black settlers. And I was just wondering, you said that there were, you know, a bunch of African-American families living on the hills of Hinesburg back in the same time that Daisy was around. I'm wondering if there was any kind of African-American community in Vermont and if they connected with each other or if they pretty much kept themselves.
Actually, I think that the Hinesburg community was much earlier. Alec didn't come to Grafton until 1873. And so there was not a crossover there.
Stephen, we actually have spoken on this program before with a historian and writer named Elise Guyette, who's written a book specifically about those families, and in particular the Hinesburg, the first families in Hinesburg, first African-American families who farmed up there. And I know the sign that you're talking about, and she talks about that in the book. We'll try to link to that show on our show page for today, because it is another fascinating story about these hill farmers and African-American founders in that part of the community. Thank you very much for the call. And let's go to Jeff, who's calling in from Lincoln. Hi, Jeff.
Hello. I just wanted to make a quick point about the idea that oral history is unreliable but still valuable. Of course, sometimes it can even be more reliable than the written record. My father's mother, Mabel Samuelson Berkovitz, was born in Vermont in the old north end of Burlington in 1898, and she was an amazing storyteller. When she was 92, I had the privilege of sitting down for many, many hours and trying to record them. Well, she would tell these stories like, I remember the first time I saw a watermelon, It was the second week of July 1904, and it was a day trip from Archibald Street in the Old North End to the Webb Farm, which is now our great shared treasure of Shelburne Farms. And she tells quickly, I'll say, this story that the circus came to town, and it was a Tuesday, she remembers, because she wasn't supposed to be there. She was supposed to be in school, but she snuck away. And then there was a written record of that account which suggested that it was a Saturday. And my grandmother insisted that it was Tuesday, and so we actually followed up and dug through and found the organizational records. And indeed, the written record that stood that was reflected in the newspaper had the incorrect day of the week, and the memory of one person who not only told a great story, but actually was the one preserving the facts. And the magic of life is you never know, and sometimes it doesn't even matter so much.
Jeff, what a great story. Thank you so much for sharing that. I appreciate it. And Jane Beck, that's a great entry point into this idea about memory and reliability and the research that you did. You say at the beginning of your book, and I'll quote you here, while memory can be unreliable, it is always meaningful. What do you mean by that?
Well, memory is emotional. It's personal. It's subjective. And what often, as the person that just called in, you know, you get personal details that nobody else knows. But I felt with Daisy's story, it was really important to document it so that people knew where it was coming from. And so when she wanted me to write the book, she felt that her storytelling wouldn't last. And she wanted her story known. So what she wanted me to do was sit there and write it out. But I knew that unless I documented it, it wouldn't be taken seriously. And so coming back to memory, I found that they were signposts. And I'll give you an example. Her father's probably the most important touchstone story for him was a raid that he was on that came back to the Golden Plantation. And
this is when he was in a cavalry unit?
This is right after he escaped, and he was a guide that led a small band back to capture an outpost of Confederate soldiers. While they are doing that, he goes off and he shoots the overseer that had been head of the whipping post that he hated worse. And this enabled him to turn his back on slavery. There are all kinds of records of this raid, but of course there isn't of shooting the overseer. I'm sure it happened. But the story is a signpost for me being able to find several different documentations of this raid, including records of the raid.
So even though you can't find proof that this overseer was killed and that the overseer was killed by Alec Turner, you believe that to be true?
I do believe that to be true because it was his most important signpost story, and it was all most important touchstone story, and it was his way of turning his back on slavery. And, you know, it almost doesn't matter. It's the emotion of that that really tells you something about slavery and Alec.
I want to play another story of Daisy's, another audio clip. This is courtesy of the Vermont Folklife Center. It's an excerpt from Daisy Turner interviews that are stored there that Jane Beck did. And this is a story that Daisy tells, but about her father. We've been talking a lot about Alec because he's a remarkable character in this family saga. So at some point in Daisy's life, her father received a letter from the markets in Boston where the family sold their poultry. And this letter claimed that the Turner's turkeys had gone bad, and so the Turner's were going to be paid less. Well, Daisy has, we can gather from many of her stories, liked to take things into her own hands. She actually hopped right on a train and she went to confront the vendor in Boston to get her family's money.
I said, you said that on this letter that my father's turkeys and the things had spoiled. And I said, Mrs. Soule helped to pick them. And I said, they all were packed in this nice paper that my father had got from you all. And we never had done this before. And I says, ours is the best in the market. And I said, those are our turkeys, and those are ours, and these are our chickens, and this is ours, and this box, I said, those are the packages. Uncle Early shot them, and I said, my brother shot these, and all of this. And I begin telling what our stuff was and hanging it. And I says, my sisters told me not to come back to show my face with those, all of the money of my daddy's money in full, so we could have our coats and the rubber boots and shoes that we've got to have for school. And they all begin, funny, they all looked like they were kind of sick.
Yeah, you can imagine Daisy saying, look, you got to pay us our money. And they did.
Well, they did. But she was able to identify all the poultry because her father clipped off the back toe of each of these birds. So, you know, she had them pretty embarrassed.
Let's go to Sean, who's calling in from Wethersfield. Hi, Sean. Go right ahead.
Hey, thank you, Jane. I love the program. And Aaron, thank you so much for doing this. I met Daisy when I was a kid, and our school went to visit the Springfield Rehab Center, and she was there. And she was cranky and interesting, and in that environment, she was definitely like a rock star. Two things. One, I wonder what it was like for her neighbors living with her there, because she, you know, was very interesting. And those places, you know, don't get a lot of visitors. And two, I would give a plug for visiting the old folks' home, because we heard a lot of interesting things, especially from her, but also from other people. So thank you.
Yeah, Sean, I bet you did. What about that, Jane Beck?
I remember going into the Springfield Convalescent Home and hearing Daisy holding forth all the way down the corridor. Yes, she was a rock star there.
And her neighbors liked her? I mean, Sean questions about that. We talked a little earlier about how she had a mixed reputation.
Well, I think by this time, you know, the people that were interested listened to her, and those that didn't tuned out.
Jane, you have preserved Daisy's story in this book, which Daisy encouraged you to write 30 years ago. She said, as you said, she wanted this written down in a book, but it was clearly very important to you to preserve her actual words, not just write her stories the way you've interpreted them. So her words are actually in this book. And I'm curious from your perspective, because you've now sat with this story for more than 30 years, and you waited till you retired and had the time to do the research and to write this book. What is Daisy Turner's legacy to you in your own head? She must be a very important person to you.
Well, she is. I mean, she gave me a wonderful opportunity to understand a period of life that I never would have had that opportunity to. And I also wanted to show how important it is to listen to stories and what they can give us. And that's what I wanted to preserve.
Well, Jane Beck's book is called Daisy Turner's Kin, an African-American Family Saga. Jane is going to be giving a talk and signing books at the Rokeby Museum in Ferrisburg at 3 p.m. on Sunday, September 27th. Jane, what a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, climate activists in Vermont are pushing hard for the state's pension plans to be divested of all fossil fuel holdings. We'll check in with VPR's Peter Hirschfeld, who's been at the pension board's meeting today, to see if all the excitement has led to a change in policy. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. To divest or not to divest, that is the question. At least it's the question before the Vermont Pension Investment Committee today. The group is considering the issue for the third time in 2 years. And VPR's Peter Hirschfeld has been at the meeting this morning where climate activists pushing for divestment were expected to turn up in force. Pete, what has the scene been like this morning?
Well, the turnout isn't massive, Jane, but there are about 36 climate change activists here from all over the state. By protest standards, I suppose 36 isn't a huge number, but I really wouldn't call this a protest per se. This is a group of people here to participate in a public meeting of the Vermont Pension Investment Committee. They've been unfailingly polite. They haven't disrupted anything. They're sitting quietly in their seats during presentations from various state officials and consultants. And they're here for the chance to speak their piece during a public comment portion of this meeting later this afternoon.
So what exactly has the Pension Investment Committee been considering this morning?
Well, the question before the board on its face at least seems pretty straightforward, and that is, should the state be investing portions of its $4 billion pension investment fund in oil, gas, and coal companies that extract and sell the fossil fuels responsible for causing climate change? This is not a new question for the committee. The panel held a formal vote on this same issue in 2013. They rejected it unanimously and then affirmed that decision last year. Simple as the wording seems, though, they say the question of divestment is a much more complicated issue than simply investing or not in these sorts of companies. And they say there's all kinds of collateral consequences that the pension fund and the people that rely on it could suffer if we went this route.
And in fact, in the two previous considerations, they decided not to divest.
Exactly. They found that adverse impacts on the fund's returns combined with fees to the fund and also just kind of complicating the manner in which they're able to move from fund to fund and commingle various investments was just too daunting to move forward with.
Pete, it sounds like we're talking to you right now at 12:45 as we go live on the show. It sounds like they haven't voted yet. Is there a guarantee that they will vote at all?
No guarantee. A decision not to vote, however, would basically be an affirmation of the previous vote in 2013 wherein they decided not to move forward with divestment. They'll make that decision at some point today. But even if they do hold a vote, I don't think anybody's holding their breath. Certainly it doesn't sound like they're ready to move in that direction yet.
Well, in fact, you spoke with Treasurer Beth Pierce, who's the vice chair of the Pension Committee, earlier today, and she said she doesn't think that the board would vote to divest. Why not?
The state has commissioned two separate analyses on what divestment might mean for the investment fund. And we heard today that based on past performance at least, divestment from fossil fuel extraction companies would cost the fund about $9 million in lost returns annually. Now, there are sharp financial minds that would argue perhaps effectively that past performance is a really suspect metric to use when you're talking about an industry in the midst of such a rapid evolution as the energy industry is. But Beth Pierce says she's looked at a number of independent data sets, none of which project positive financial results if the state does opt for the divestment route. And Beth Pierce, director of investments, a guy named Matt Considine, says the issue of fossil fuel divestment just isn't as straightforward as the question would have you believe. He says, why are we focusing on extraction? Why not emissions? And if we do bring our focus to that, there are lots of companies that have a much more profound negative impact on climate change than the guys who are actually taking the oil out of the ground to begin with. And he says that before the state moves in this direction, it really needs to think about what a divestment proposal should look like if you want it to achieve the ends that its proponents are looking to reach.
When we've had Treasurer Pierce on the show before, she said also it's the fiduciary responsibility of the pension board to make sure that it's getting the best possible return. Would it even be, I guess legal is probably not the right word, but ethical of the board to divest if what they believed was that it would actually significantly reduce the earnings in the pension funds?
Frankly, it's easy enough for the board to change its own policies to allow for the adoption of a divestment proposal. Under the current policy as it's written, perhaps that would be a stumbling block. But as one board member pointed out earlier today, if they care enough about this, if they believe in it enough to move forward with it, then it shouldn't be that difficult to redraft the policies that govern their actions.
Well, given that, Pete, is it fair to say then that the board doesn't care enough about it if what you're saying is it's very, very unlikely that they would vote to divest?
Beth Pierce will not emphasize enough to you that she believes climate change is real, that it poses a serious threat to our society, and that markets and the people who invest in them need to take bold steps to address it. But she's convinced that doing this now would harm the pension fund that 48,000 Vermonters in this state rely on for annual income, And economics aside, Beth Pearce says divestment misses the mark when it comes to advancing the climate change agenda. She argues that shareholders in a publicly traded company have the capacity to subvert from within, if you will, and that they lose their access to the power brokers at places like ExxonMobil or Chevron or any of the other oil and gas companies when they choose to divest and give up that sort of democratic participation in the shareholder process.
Nonetheless, there are quite a few groups and activists in the state who are pushing for divestment. They say this is the best way to shift the needle. And as you said, there are, you know, several of them are out today trying to encourage the pension committee to think about this in a different way. So they're unlikely to be satisfied by that response.
Absolutely. We had groups 350.org and the Sierra Club actually organizing today's event, and this is one of the primary fronts on their climate change battle. And for them, this is as much about changing social conventions as it is about undermining the economic foundation of fossil fuel industries. They want to publicly shame oil, gas, and coal industries. They want to color the lens that regular folks see these industries through. The divestment movement wants you to read about stories where high-profile institutions like the state of Vermont are divesting, and they want these actions to stigmatize fossil fuel companies in the same way that we saw the public discussion about cigarettes, say, lead to the demonization of big tobacco. Does divestment undermine the financial footing of those companies? People can disagree on that question. What it is sure to do, though, if you ask these divestment proponents, is cripple the public approval ratings for companies like Chevron, like ExxonMobil. And that shift in public perception, they say, is going to create the political environment needed to make real progress on greenhouse gas reductions.
VPR's Peter Hirschfeld telling us about the meeting today of the Vermont Pension Investment Committee, which has been considering whether or not to divest its portfolio from companies that support the fossil fuel industry. Peter, thank you very much.
Thanks, Jane.
You might be surprised to learn that the night crawlers, typically sold in bait shops, are imported from Canada. But your yard has a plentiful supply of them. All it takes is a flashlight and a little stealth to catch your own. For today's installment of Summer School, we visit a fellow who's caught thousands of them to learn how to catch night crawlers.
Hi, my name is Don Russell. We're in Randolph, Vermont. It's around 10 o'clock at night. We are out picking night crawlers tonight. I sell them, try to make a little money for my grandson, but he wants a new bike, and I was trying to show him that he had to work for him. I have a good, very good lawn here that it's about an acre. Sometimes I use neighbors' property, cemeteries, golf courses if they'll let you own them. I pick up to like 500 at a night, and I'm ready to go out tonight and do 500 of them or so if I can. The conditions are rainy, which are usually the best, wet ground. Humidity's really good, and right now we have plenty of that. Might be a little too early, but I think we can have, as the night progresses, we'll definitely be able to pick them. You try to use a flashlight where you can see, but it doesn't spread too much of a wide beam, so you don't scare more night crawlers around as you're getting the ones that you try to pick up. You have to walk very gently, because vibration will scare the other ones off around you. You'll see a shiny, it almost looks like a stick. There's a little one right there. And he's fully extended out. It's a very small crawler. And you have to get a hold of him, try to squeeze them, and pull them out of the ground. Really just barely sticking out of their hole. And you want to wait late enough so that they're actually fully out on the ground. Midnight, 1 o'clock is the best time to do it. There's one right here. There's another. You don't really want to catch more than you're either going to use. You like to get rid of them within a week or two. I keep mine in my dirt floor cellar in a big bin with a lot of leaves, wet leaves. I do feed them. I have stuff I buy at a store. Most sporting goods stores carry it. It's called worm food. I am a fisherman, very avid fisherman. Love my walleye fishing. That's my favorite. And I use night crawlers. The best bait there is pretty much other than bloodsuckers. And most people don't want to use bloodsuckers. So we tend to use the night crawlers because my wife and my family can bait their own hooks and deal with them.
Steve Zind produced that piece. And look, we want to know what you want to learn in summer school. You can write to us at vermontedition@vpr.net and tune in every week for a new lesson. Go to vpr.net and write in summer school in the search engine if you want to hear all of our summer school pieces that we've produced over the years. And again, tell us what you want to learn in summer school. That's it for today. Tomorrow, a new exhibit at the Shelburne Museum puts beautiful and surprising Vermont furniture in the spotlight. We'll talk about the past and present of Vermont woodworking. Send your questions and comments to vermontedition@vpr.net and join us tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sam Gale Rosen. Aaron Lucy produced today's show. Liam Connors directed the program, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. Our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.